Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The names may have changed, but the politics of financial reform really haven't. What's next in the debt limit debate? Our best guess. And why you should never steal? Because one day, your mother's going to find out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, today the 18th of July. Really good to have you with us, as it always is. There is nothing, the saying goes, like a deadline to concentrate the mind. So with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau set to open up for business this week, today President Obama finally got around to deciding who he wants to run the place. Richard Cordray is the name, former Attorney General of the great state of Ohio, and, as the president said at the White House today, oh so much more.
Back in the 80s, Richard was also a five-time Jeopardy champion and a semifinalist in the Tournament of Champions. Not too shabby.
I love that little laugh there. No, not too shabby at all, but Richard Cordray is no Elizabeth Warren. She's been running the Bureau, in function if not actual title, since it was created a year or so ago. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has the story.
Elizabeth Warren is a tough act to follow. Here's a former student.
When I am in Washington with her, people do stop and introduce themselves and shake her hand and ask her questions.
Catherine Porter is now a law professor at the University of California, Irvine. She says Warren's scrappy, fight-for-the-people attitude has made her popular. It's also made her polarizing.
This is a compromise appointment.
Rob Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation. A little background. Warren was tapped as interim head of the Bureau about a year ago. She brought Richard Cordray into the agency. The agency is supposed to officially open for business on Thursday.
He's far more of a on-the-ground negotiator, enforcer, really the buck stops here type of guy.
As Ohio Attorney General, Cordray sued loan servicers for violating state consumer laws and went after financial firms for what he called fraudulent foreclosure practices. George Mason University law professor Todd Zwicky says confirmation could still be a problem.
Cordray would be a perfectly palatable and reasonable choice if he were, say, one member of a five-member bipartisan commission.
Republicans are pushing for a commission instead of one director of the Bureau. They've said they'll block any appointment. Maybe Jeopardy should consider a new category. Contentious political confirmations for 500? I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Here's one I wish I could claim credit for, but sadly can't. The whole scandal with Rupert Murdoch's media empire and his British papers? Murdochalypse. It's pretty good, right? Shares of Murdoch's News Corp continued their downward price spiral today. It's off more than 16% the past couple of weeks. More than $6 billion in shareholder value gone just like that. There's all kinds of speculation that Murdoch's control of the company could even be threatened. Still, and with the caveat that it all depends, a lot of analysts are expecting News Corp to emerge shaken but mainly intact. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
So why the rush to unload News Corp stock at the same time many analysts have maintained a recommendation to buy? At High Point Capital Management, investment advisor Gautam Dhingra believes there's little threat to News Corp's biggest U.S. operations, including its crown jewel TV and cable properties.
Personally speaking, I think the assets are worth a lot. I would say the reputation of Fox News at this point is undamaged.
Dhingra sees this as a buying opportunity for investors, provided they're satisfied Fox News is clean.
If, however, the shareholders do not want to take a chance that the U.S. assets might be tainted, then it's time to bail.
But considering the company is on track to generate about $7 billion in operating cash flow in the year ahead, some analysts argue the sell-off has gone too far. James Dix watches News Corp for Wedbush Securities.
Seems to me as though they're probably over-discounting what the likely results are going to be on the downside.
But Dix concedes investors hate uncertainty, and the future at News Corp is still too cloudy.
To the extent the outlook for the stock depends on the outcome of investigations of conduct at the News of the World, those investigations can take time, and as a result, you can have volatility in the stock price for some time.
And before you think the news from London doesn't affect you, consider you might, at least indirectly, already own a piece of News Corp. Its top institutional shareholders range from Goldman Sachs and other investment banks to Vanguard, Invesco, and other big-name mutual funds. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Of the many, many things that could have helped drive stocks down today, European banks were definitely one of them. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So this happened on the drive into work this morning. I was flipping the radio dial around, landed on a story about debt ceiling negotiations, and got completely lost. From what they were saying, I had no idea what was happening, what's going to happen, what could be happening to the full faith and credit of the United States come August the 2nd, if, in fact, that is the actual date of the financial apocalypse. So with the understanding that this will be a different story tomorrow, we've gotten Marketplace's David Gura on the line from Washington to explain where things stand right now, with the emphasis on the right now part. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
So as much as you can, given the way this story is changing, what's the thinking right now in the debt debate?
Well, I wish I knew. I think everyone is sort of wondering what everybody else is thinking. So you've got Democrats wondering what kind of deal the Republicans are going to go for. And then you've got a lot of division in the Republican Party. You've got Senate Republicans wondering what their colleagues in the House are going to go for. So all in all, just a ton of confusion here. But it does seem like both sides are interested in or are interested in investing in some sort of compromise package. And the one that's sort of leading the pack right now is the one that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell put forward last week. Since then, he and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid have been working on it, and it may be the best hope to get something done before August 2nd.
Okay, so details, please, in understandable English, if you will.
You got it. So the debt ceiling would go up. President Obama would get the power to do that in three stages. And every time that happened, there'd be a Senate vote, something along the lines of, be it resolved, we disapprove of the president doing this. And now that would allow his opponents to make their opposition known. And in exchange for that, the GOP would get $1.5 trillion in cuts. There'd be no new taxes. And there'd be a commission that would look at ways to save money down the line. But the thing is, Congress can't take up this compromise right away.
Because?
Well, a big part of the House GOP doesn't like it.
Right.
They're pushing for something called cut, cap, and balance.
Right.
They're saying you can raise the debt ceiling by about $2.4 trillion if you cut the deficit, tie how much the U.S. government can spend to our gross domestic product, our GDP, and have a constitutional amendment that would mandate a balanced budget. Now, look, the House may pass this. They've got a Republican majority. There's no way the Senate's going to pass this. The White House just renamed this thing Dodge, Duck, and Dismantle, so everyone's having fun with alliteration. I mean, here's the thing. Neither House can debate the McConnell-Reed compromise until this plan, which includes the constitutional amendment, goes through Congress.
The president met last night, though, with John Boehner and Eric Cantor, the majority leader in the House of Representatives. I mean, is there any kind of real progress being made?
That's right. They met right after the Women's World Cup
mm-hmm.
game. The president was hoping for $4 trillion in savings over the next 10 years. That would come from spending cuts and higher taxes that the White House would be shouldered by wealthier Americans and corporations. The White House is still pushing for this. I don't think the odds are that great. After that meeting last night, both sides said the purpose of that meeting was just sort of keep lines of communication open. Kyle, you've probably noticed there are a lot of plans here and mm-hmm. not a whole lot of time left.
Talk to me about that really quickly for a second. What's the actual date by which Washington has to have some kind of plan on the table?
Right. August 2nd is the date the Treasury Department says is when they can no longer meet their obligations. But, you know, bureaucracy is a slow-moving animal. And this legislation, some compromise is going to have to start making its way through Congress pretty soon. Some say as soon as later this week.
Is that literally just so they can write the bill and get it signed and proof-checked and all that stuff?
That's right. It's entirely procedural.
David Gura in Washington for us. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Honest people can disagree about whether there's a technology boom building right now, but it is pretty clear that social media is bubbling right along. LinkedIn went public to huge fanfare a couple of months ago. Groupon's IPO is coming soon enough. Facebook is expected to go public sometime early next year. And that company may be worth $50 billion. Some say double that. So far, so good for venture capitalists and early investors. And one might expect an internet startup binge like that to lead to a boom in jobs, yeah? Right about here is where those expectations ought to be adjusted. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman explains.
Prineville, Oregon, population 10,000. It's a small ranching town in the high desert, best known for its rowdy summer rodeo.
Bobby Moat has drawn the horse that won the championship 2 weeks ago.
At the depths of the recession, unemployment here soared above 20%, with sawmills and construction shut down. Then, last year, Facebook came to town.
In the data center we go. I have a biometric reader here, fingerprint accessible.
Ken Patchett is operations manager for Facebook's first global data center. It's 300,000 square feet of spanking new servers where Facebook's half-billion users meet for a few nanoseconds in cyberspace. Construction started last year. Facebook hired 1,400 contractors, some from out of town. Mark Zuckerberg dropped in from Palo Alto for a flashy opening ceremony in April. Senior managers came in to run the place.
The fact that we're this big internet company coming into a rural area, people have difficulty mapping those two things together, right? Oh, these big California boys coming up, going to take over the planet.
To show it isn't, Facebook has contracted with local carpenters and sheet metal shops to finish the build-out. There's an 8-foot wooden Sasquatch in the lobby and quilts by local senior citizens. But most important, Facebook's been hiring.
I lost my job last year, and then it was just kind of unemployment and then part-time jobs here and there.
Sam Viles landed a job as a server tech in February. He's 25, he doesn't have a college degree, and worked for a time as a call center technician.
And this job kind of got dropped in my lap, and then I couldn't believe it. I was in a job that gave me enough money to pay bills.
The average salary for Facebook workers here is $53,000, 1.5 times the typical county wage. Under a property tax exemption worth millions to Facebook, the company has to employ at least 35 full-time workers, says Ken Patchett.
I've got, I think it might be up to 47 right now. This includes all of our security staff, facility staff, server technician staff.
Patchett says it's not likely to go much higher.
These are not large job-generating companies.
Hank Notoff is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and author of Great Again, Revitalizing America's Entrepreneurial Leadership.
So here you have a company with an $80 billion market cap, creating phenomenal wealth for a very few. And then on top of that, it's not creating jobs.
Of course, running servers requires a lot of power, but not many people. And social media sites like Facebook don't need many employees posting content. We users do that, all those messages and photos and likes and pokes, for free. So add in all the fancy programmers and marketing types in Palo Alto and around the world, Facebook still only has 2,500 employees total. Apple has 20 times that. Sony employs 170,000. And those jobs generate more jobs.
High-tech manufacturing will actually create up to 15 additional jobs. Companies like a Facebook, a Zynga, a Twitter, for every job they create, even though they're very high-paying positions, they create about 2.5 jobs.
Well, I think, you know, every little bit helps.
I met Jeff Anderson at his Tasty Treat burger joint on the main drag through town. Some bikers had just rolled in on their way to a rally in Hell's Canyon. They ordered, whipped out cell phones, and updated their Facebook pages. Anderson says Facebook's friending a lot of folks in town.
So, you know, if you get 30, 40, 50 jobs, that's possibly 50 families that show up here. And, you know, they have to grocery shop, they go out to eat, ice cream, sports, all that. So it will make a difference.
Realtors say the local housing market is picking up, and the dry climate, available workforce, and local tax breaks have enticed several other tech firms to consider building data centers here, now that Facebook's put Prineville on the map. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think people want things that they can't have, and it's incredibly exciting to steal.
The five-finger discount explained. But first, let's do the numbers. Default worries from Europe to the U.S. had investors selling today, although Wall Street did recover from early lows. The Dow Industrial slid 94 points, about 0.75%, closed at 12,385. The NASDAQ gave back 24 points, 0.9%, finished at 2,765. The S&P 500 fell 10 points, 0.8%, ended things at 1,305. Financial stocks led the sell-off, but wider economic concerns hit industrial companies, too. Boeing felt the turbulence, lost 2.4% today. Alcoa lost luster as shares of the aluminum maker gave back 2%. Apple defied the downdraft ahead of expected strong earnings this week. Its shares gained nearly 2.5%. But any company that missed its profit target felt investor pain. Take toymaker Hasbro, just for instance. Shares there fell 4.75% today. Meantime, as the phone hacking scandal widens, News Corp shriveled another 4%. But then again, on this down day, the New York Times lost nearly 3% as well. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for June. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses enhanced consumer financial protection after the financial crisis. And above Earth, Space Shuttle Atlantis is scheduled to undock from the International Space Station for the last time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The heat goes on. 17 states up and down the heart of the country, from Texas to Minnesota, had excessive heat advisories today. There's at least another week of pain on the way, well beyond what most Midwestern economies are used to dealing with. And businesses are sweating it out, too. From the thick of it in St. Paul, Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz has more.
Before I sat down to write this, I thought I'd better force myself out of the AC one last time. It's like walking through that jungle room at the zoo, maybe with a toaster a few inches from your face. It slows everything down.
We are seeing a softer economy, and this will certainly just compound that.
Economist Ernie Goss is at Creighton University in Omaha. Heat index today, 108.
As companies have to, and individuals and families have to spend more on electricity and taking care of this heat, they're going to have less money to spend on other items.
Goss says tourism and trucking in the upper Midwest are already hurting from intense rain and flooding this summer. Heat will make things worse. But the rain and dew point are a blessing for crop farmers when the heat sets in.
Plants can tolerate it more when you've got the humid conditions.
Dave Miller is a farmer and research director for the Iowa Farm Bureau. But timing is everything. Hot weather past the end of the week could interfere with corn pollination. For all you non-farmers, that's bad.
Well, if it doesn't pollinate, it doesn't produce. Then we would expect corn prices to start moving back up towards record levels, which would translate most likely into higher pork and beef prices.
At the height of the summer festival season, the heat's a real buzzkill for outdoor entertainment, unless, of course, you name your concert fortuitously.
Hot as Hell Festival, when you headline with Rob Zombie, it made good sense.
Promoter Jamie Fitzgerald says thousands turned out in searing heat in Tulsa this weekend, defying/celebrating the fact that Oklahoma is nearing one straight month of days topping 100. In St. Paul, heat index today 113. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Extreme weather stresses local budgets in lots of ways. Down in Florida, a state it's worth pointing out for this next story that was largely built out of marshland, cities and towns are battling record swarms of mosquitoes. And they're doing it, as Marketplace's Eve Tro tells us, with a lot less ammunition.
Florida's itching from the worst skeeter season in a decade. The state has cut money for bug control, so local officials are mostly on their own. In Brevard County on the East Coast, biologist Chris Richmond says a mosquito hotline rings and rings. Many callers are newcomers. They didn't know it got this bad.
Anything from please do not spray anywhere near my house to, you know, please, you know, drive by my house as many times as you can.
Richmond says he can't add new staff, and his sprayers are working two shifts a day.
We have to constantly fight.
Across the state, Sarasota County Commissioner Nora Patterson says shooting down skeeters is vital to the economy.
I think mosquito control and air conditioning are probably the two things that started a building boom in the state of Florida.
Most counties pay into a mosquito control fund with property tax. With the real estate bust, the fund is almost empty. She says raising taxes to fill it would cost homeowners about $10 more a year, so less than a few cans of off. But she says for some politicians, raising taxes stings too much.
I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Here's a bit of mixed news. Shoplifting is on the rise, and that could mean the economy is slowly recovering. The National Retail Federation finds that a lot of the recent spike is from employee theft. And so the fact that they're stealing means they're not as scared about losing their jobs. Or it may mean that people are unemployed, angry, and want to take it out on somebody. Rachel Steyer has written a book about the historical and cultural attitudes toward shoplifting. It's called The Steal. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Is it too simple to say at the amateur level that people are doing it for the thrill of getting something for nothing?
No, that's not too simple at all. I think that's enormously complex. I think people want things that they can't have, and it's incredibly exciting to steal.
The thrill of potentially being caught, right?
The thrill of being caught or the thrill of getting away with it, of being smarter than the store, of being against the store, kind of mano a mano, as it were.
And when you're talking about amateurs, I mean, it's not just John Q. Public. You can't do this interview without talking about Winona Ryder and Lindsay Lohan. I mean, explain that.
Yeah. Well, I think a common misconception is that amateur shoplifting arises out of lack of money. The truth is that most amateur shoplifting arises out of want, either, as you say, the thrill or the desire to get something for nothing, or as a kind of impulse control disorder or as a disease. There are lots of different ways to talk about why amateurs are stealing. But one thing that the most recent research does show pretty much across the board is that it's not driven by need, as in Jean Valjean, I'd like to steal a loaf of bread.
That's right. Yeah. Is it, are we talking here like nickel and dime stuff? Or we, I mean, it's not like millions of dollars, right?
Well, the most recent figures are $12 billion a year.
Yes, in the aggregate, it's a whole lot of money. But I mean,
person to person.
A pair of earrings, a book, you know, a scarf or something.
Amateurs, yes, steal small things. You're absolutely right. Rings, books, bubblegum, etc. And then professionals steal more in bulk.
The pros do it to sell, right?
Right. The pros do it to resell on eBay. And by volume, that is the biggest problem that the retail industry has right now in dollar amount. Mm-hmm. Amateurs steal probably the most volume, but the dollar amount adds up to less.
Not to personalize this, but how much does it cost the average consumer? How much does aggregated shoplifting cost me when I go into a store to buy, I don't know, a DVD player or something?
The so-called crime tax, what it costs the American family is around $400.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That stinks.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it really does. Do you know how many people admit to being shoplifters or having done it in the past?
Yes. There was one large-scale study done at Columbia University in 2008. It's the most recent, the only large-scale study on shoplifting that I've ever seen done, actually. And I think that the statistic there is around 27 million people.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So listen, on the theory that there's one chance in 10 that the answer to this question is going to be yes, did you ever shoplift?
Oh, when I was a kid, I stole some bubble gum.
Oh, see, no, me too. Woolworths. That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
That's what you were going to say.
It was Pete's Candy Store in the Village in Barker's Manor, yeah. And I actually got caught, too. But anyway.
That's my goodness.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
By Pete? Yeah,
but he was this is a terrible thing, and my mom's going to yell at me. He was kind of an old guy, and so he just grabbed me. And it was me and my buddy, and he turned us around and made us put it back, and that was it. And now, Mom, you know.
Oh, so your mom never knew before
this
moment.
She knows now.
Wow.
She knows now. Rachel Steyer, her book is called The Steal. It's a cultural history of shoplifting. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Mom, I'm real sorry. There's an excerpt of The Steal on our book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, on the theory that news of business and the economy can be dense, an explainer.
So what exactly is a derivatives product?
Derivative products are a lot about leverage.
Got it. So what is leverage exactly?
A lot of leverage is about maximizing your margins.
Okay. So how would you define margins?
Yeah, margins really come into play when talking about derivatives.
Okay. So what is a derivatives product?
They're kind of like stocks.
For our listeners who aren't well-versed in finance, what are stocks?
They fluctuate. Stocks definitely fluctuate.
What does that mean exactly?
It means that the market is cyclical.
And by the market, you mean?
Buy low, sell high.
I'm sorry, what?
Supply and demand.
Excuse me?
Nature versus nurture.
Nature versus?
Mi casa es su casa.
What?
Mi casa es su casa.
You don't even know what derivatives are, do you?
Maybe. Maybe not. Our skit was written by Insanitas Comedy. Michelle Phillippe and Jonathan Karp brought it to life. Hear it again and find a link to Insanitas on our website. It's marketplace.org. That's it. We're done. It's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow slid 94 points, about 0.75%. The NASDAQ gave back 24 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 fell 10 points, 0.8%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, why television is hoping to make a splash at the big comic book convention.
The kind of people that like superhero movies, if they like something and they're on board with it, they sell it. There's something about the nerd fan that you don't get with other fans.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.